Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Let us start with David Cameron. David Cameron, in some respects, was the Conservatives' answer to Tony Blair, in a sense that the idea that the country clearly wanted a vacuous individual able to promise a better future in which everything would be sorted out, and indeed which the individual in question was polished, young, certainly young by the standards of modern prime ministers, a sort of well-spoken public schoolboy, that appeared to be what people felt was necessary. And as it were, it was almost as if David Cameron was weaponized in order to be Tony Blair's rival. You may recall, listeners may recall, that the Conservative Party had a very successful run of general elections under two successive prime ministers, Margaret Thatcher, who won 3 general elections and was then got rid of by a parliamentary party, many of whom will never be remembered, whereas she certainly will be, and then replaced by John Major, who, to the surprise of many, won the 1992 general election, who served as a figure of great probity, but who took the stick for, in a sense, a growing disquiet among some in the mid-1990s. In hindsight, of course, and it should have been obvious at the time, Major was a considerably better prime minister, more probity, more grounding than his Labour rival in 1997. Anyway, the Conservatives then went through a rapid period of internal crisis. It's interesting that people tend to think of the last few years of 2016 to the present as years of Conservative crisis, as though those have in leadership, as though those have never happened hitherto, which of course is ridiculous. The period of 1997 up to 2005 was one of instability. John Major himself didn't stay to be forced out. He actually resigned at once, which may have been a matter of great personal sort of sense that he was no longer fit for purpose, but in practical terms, did not necessarily lead to the most helpful of immediate aftermaths. Anyway, the Conservatives produced an effective and able a successor in William Hague, but William Hague was not liked by the electorate, was unfairly typecast as extreme, and I think it's fair to say was outmaneuvered by Blair, even though it was quite clear that Hague was a more able man. There was then a period under Ian Duncan Smith, not the most distinguished of leaders, and one who was got rid of without actually even having to face the humiliation of a general election defeat. Then Michael Howard, and on Michael Howard's election defeat, there was a choice between David Cameron and the more experienced David Davis. Now, in many senses, Cameron was largely unknown. He had got a seat in Parliament only as recently as 2000, a seat for, he'd been selected as for Witney. He'd only won the seat thereafter in the general election in 2001. And of course, Cameron did relatively little between 2001 and 2005. He presented himself as an urbane figure. He became the front bench local government spokesman in 2004, and then shadow election secretary, education secretary. But it cannot be said that he had much to offer in terms of experience, ability, actually a grounding in the nation, although he clearly benefited from the support of, how shall one say, well-connected figures within the party, many of whom indeed had been with him at Eton. Marked a resumption of the public school tradition of conservative leadership, which had last been seen in terms of actually a prime minister with Sir Alec Douglas Hume, the Earl of Hume, who'd been prime minister in 1963 to 1964. Subsequently, the Conservative prime ministers, Edward Heath, Margaret Thatcher, and John Major had all had a different upbringing, and it might well be said, I would certainly say it, more of a grounding with the electorate and indeed the party. Anyway, Cameron benefited from his well-received speech at the party conference, one that he spoke without notes, which is always impressive, but actually it does help if you've got something to say. Cameron had singularly little to say, but it sounded good and people didn't stop to think. And indeed, Cameron became leader of the opposition with a very good majority of a ballot of the party. Over Davis. Davis was much more experienced, but he'd given a disappointing conference speech, and that appears to have been largely it. Now, as leader of the opposition, Cameron sought to modernise the Conservatives that's how he presented it, in a way that matched Blair's, and sought to lead it from the political centre of the country, in other words, the left wing of the Conservative Party. Indeed, the right of the party, Norman Tebbit, compared Cameron to Pol Pot, the Cambodian dictator, intent on purging Thatcherism completely. And I think it's fair to say that Cameron himself made really very little attempt to disguise his political affiliation. He was fortunate in the sense that Labour was in grave difficulties because it was getting tired, because Tony Blair's replacement, Gordon Brown, was lackluster, lacking in charisma, and indeed seemed only to be able to answer problems by throwing other people's money at them. But on the other hand, Cameron himself also appeared to be not quite the right answer to a country that was struggling increasingly with economic and fiscal difficulties in the late 2000s. It was as if, purposed in order to oppose Blair as a similarly glib and vacuous politician, he had instead found himself rapidly opposed to Brown, where it was difficult to match Brown's ponderous solidity, whilst at the same time showing a kind of affinity or understanding of the country as a whole. And there are various ways of looking at the 2010 general election. Obviously, at the time, the fact that the Conservatives beat Labour to become the largest individual party appeared, very impressive. But the fact was that was 20 seat short of an overall majority and resulted in the nation's first hung parliament since February 74. Now, you can look at this different ways, and indeed, I think it's fair to say that subsequent elections, those of 2015, 2017 and 2019, cast an interesting light on the results of the 2010 election. In each of those elections, the Conservatives won more votes than they did in 2010. And in the 2019 election, they actually took considerably more seats. Well, they took more seats, of course, in the others, but the 2019, considerably more seats. And what that in a way highlights is that Cameron didn't really articulate an adequate reason to vote Conservative in 2010. I can recall this myself. Both of my children voting in the first parliamentary election, first general election, said to me that David Cameron had given no particular reason to people like them to vote Conservative. And I think that that was more generally a feeling that he was not a campaigner that knew how to engage with the public. He lacked the kind of skills in that respect and genuine affinity shown by Margaret Thatcher and John Major. Indeed, in some respects, he was more like a slightly smoother, come out of the Magimix much better, version of Edward Heath. In that he didn't really seem terribly comfortable with real people. And indeed, friends of mine who were Conservatives who served under him in the government in the early 20-teens tell me that he very much ran the cabinet and the parliamentary party as a chums group in which most ministers were not actually open to, their advice wasn't really, you know, Cameron wasn't particularly open to it because of their social failure to mix at the level that he assumed. Now, that's hearsay. I don't personally know whether that's true or not. I only met him once to talk to. I was very unimpressed, but then, you know, not working with somebody is not the best basis to form a judgment. But it is certainly the case that in 2010, he was perceived by many as being less good a candidate than was required. And the hung parliament was one in which the Conservatives in the end did well in creating a Conservative Liberal Democrat government, but you could look at that the other way round and say that Cameron left the danger open of a Liberal Democrat Labour government, and that that might have occurred under had Labour been run by a better or more effective or more astute leader, possibly even the ghastly Tony Blair would have done a better job than Gordon Brown in the opportunities created by the 2010 general election. And it could also be said that Cameron and his chums allowed themselves, possibly deliberately, but that's less clear, to be outmaneuvered by the Liberal Democrats in creating what was, in effect, are a right-centre coalition rather than a deal which would have been harder on the Liberal Democrats, but where they themselves only had, they hadn't done as well as they had anticipated, not received the breakthrough that they'd assumed. So different arguments can be made. Now, in government, David Cameron, of course, in government from 2010 to 2016, in terms of a coalition government from 2010 to 2015, and then a majority Conservative government, a government Conservative government from 2015 to 2016. The latter very much shadowed by, in the historical memory, by the discussion of Brexit. If we look at the first 5 years, we can consider how now they appear. First of all, it's unclear in some respects the degree to which Cameron actually focused on the details of government and how far of matters which we associate with the Conservative government, Conservative Liberal Democrat government of that period, should be attributed to him. So quite clearly, the proportional representation referendum was a Liberal Democrat measure. And it went well from the point of view of the Conservatives, very badly from the point of view of the Liberal Democrats, looking towards, in a sense, as a result, the 2015 general election result. Possibly, it led Cameron to be neglectful of the nature and consequences of referenda, that they may produce an unexpected result, possibly overly influenced by short-term political criteria. I can think of the referendum that got rid of Charles de Gaulle in 1969. Although, obviously, depending upon your views of the Brexit or indeed Scottish referenda of 2016 and 2014, respectively, you might have differing interpretations of this. Anyway, from Cameron's point of view, he then subsequently got the referenda wrong. In 2014, the result was for Scotland to stay in the Union, but there had been a bit of a panic. And in 2016, from his point of view, the wrong result was delivered. And that led to the end of his political career and to him subsequently going off to sort of, you know, resigning from Parliament and subsequently going off to try and ingratiate himself in the ways of earning money. Indeed, I have to say, twice in the period after 2016, I was sitting on the table next to him at gatherings, and Cameron in each case was lobbying a different prominent Conservative figure. In the first case, a senior cabinet minister, and in the second case, a very senior parliamentarian, for his own self-interest, completely oblivious as to whether other people could hear him, which I thought showed an interesting light on his sense of self-assurance and entitlement. Anyway, back to Cameron in government. On the global scale, I suppose one might argue that it is his policies in the Libya and Syria crisis that caused the greatest long-term damage. In the case of the Syria crisis, he couldn't deliver his own party. And what that meant was that, having given assurances to America about supporting American attacks on the Assad regime, which, let us remember, was dropping poison gas from canisters on its own people, the failure of the British government led to the Americans to pull back. I personally think Obama should have gone ahead. It's not as though he needed to be dependent on Britain, but nevertheless, it was a failure. It was a failure that helped to consolidate Assad in Syria, and it was a major success for Assad's patron and puppet master, Vladimir Putin, which of course did not subsequently augur well for his policies in Ukraine. In the case of Libya, Cameron enthusiastically very much pushed the war in Libya. I can recall taking a Eurostar back from Paris on the day I was there for other reasons, on the day he'd gone to see Sarkozy there. And standing in the cafe was a sort of press figure ringing up and talking to a subsequent press figure in London about how David wanted some news item inserted in some British newspaper. I think it was the Sunday Times. I wasn't listening that closely, but I did point out to this chap that anybody could have recorded what he said. But I think there was a similar sense of vacuousness surrounding Cameron as there was in him with him himself. Anyway, the Libya disaster, which is what it became, helped to cause what has continued to be a long-standing crisis, not just in Libya, but one in which it spread out to encompass the deterioration in instability in the Sahel, particularly in Mali, and also, of course, to cause a major upsurge in illegal immigration in the central Mediterranean. and in generally in the instability of the Central and Eastern Mediterranean. So well done, David Cameron. What it showed was a remarkable lack of an ability to understand that actions may have consequences that you do not envisage, a major lack of understanding of the need to consider intelligence in its broader fashion, or to have intelligence in one's broader fashion, and a major lack of an understanding of the need to be able to plan in the medium and the long term, as well as the short term. Now, compared to these egregious and disastrous failings, what he did in terms of whatever you might think about it, homosexual marriage or other issues, were relatively inconsequential. Indeed, what one might argue is that David Cameron did very little on the domestic stage. The most important minister was quite clearly George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who very much followed a kind of policy of as it, keeping the Prime Minister in a sort of contained area, rather like Brown towards Blair. And other senior ministers, one can think of Michael Gove at Education or Theresa May at the Home Office, followed policies in which the Prime Minister appeared to be a figure of relatively little consequence. Anyway, he won the 2015 general election, helped by division and disenchantment in and with the Liberal Democrats, and helped, of course, also by the way in which Labour, with its track record of producing rather curious prime ministerial candidates, turned up with a Miliband who made even Gordon Brown appear to have a handful of talents. So Cameron won and promptly blew it. Now, you can take different views on Brexit. I've written quite extensively on it. What I think is the case is that the vote for Brexit reflected both a genuine disenchantment, widespread disenchantment with the European Union and with its apparent long-term structural development towards the federal state, but also reflected, as is only to be expected, short-term crises. Number one crises, the European migration crisis, caused essentially by Syrian refugees, although Libyan refugees were also important, and the sense that the European Union was going to redistribute those in a mandatory fashion, which may or may not have been the case, but actually the key thing was a sense that Europe itself was slipping a bit out of control. We can take the bit out of it. And secondly, and as again, the comparison with the fall of de Gaulle in 69, as a result of a referendum on essentially the governance of French regions, reflected this. Secondly, a sense in domestic terms that Cameron didn't really connect terribly well with the electorate. And on top of that, that there were a number of reasons of uneasiness or unpopularity to do with the government. Now, one has to be clear about this. The result was close. So a lot of people were, despite whatever doubts they might have, either enthusiastic about the European Union or willing to give Cameron the benefit of the doubt. But the fact that he lost indicates that his grip on politics had gone. Indeed, you might say of politicians that you don't necessarily expect them to be intelligent, you don't necessarily expect them to have integrity, you don't necessarily expect them to have foresight, but you do expect them to be able to do politics. And one thing that David Cameron clearly was unable to do in 2016 was do politics. He couldn't renegotiate the British relationship within the European Union to a degree that he had led people to assume he would do. He failed to campaign successfully, and his response to the result was unimpressive. So one could argue that on all of those bases, David Cameron is a study in failure, to use a famous term by Robert Rhodes James, about somebody of considerably more impressive character, to wit, Winston Churchill. Indeed, one's in the interesting case with Cameron of considering a party leader who gained power as a result of a general election, which he didn't completely win, but then won an outright majority in the next general election, was prime minister for 6 years, which many people would consider impressive outcomes, but nevertheless was a failure. And that is an interesting question as to how we assess success and failure. Graham.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black, for that somewhat short than ringing endorsement of David Cameron and his period in office. I wonder if it's quite clear that he would fail the high bar of statesmanship, but as a politician, can one give him a degree of credit in that he came in to office at a difficult time politically, in the sense he had to form a coalition, a difficult time economically, inheriting the hangover following the 2008 credit crunch. Can one say that he pursued a middling course? What's described as austerity was neither as bleak as opponents of it make out, but it did nevertheless help steady finances, and he kept the show on the road for his 5 or 6 years in office, something which subsequent prime ministers have struggled to do.
Well, I think that you could say all of those. That doesn't mean that necessarily one should, as I said, I've produced a critical account. I think that all prime ministers inherit a situation of difficulty from their predecessors. And I don't think Cameron was unusual in that. I would argue that Margaret Thatcher inherited a much more difficult position in 1979 from the Callaghan government as the winter of discontent came to an end. You could argue that the Attlee government inherited a more difficult position in 45, the Churchill government in 51, and so on. So I think inheriting difficult positions is not something that is new, nor is having to adjust public finances. I mean, I'd like us to think about when you last considered a British government whose public finances were in a brilliant situation. So I think one has to be wary of pushing those positive reasons for reinterpretation too far. But, obviously people will have differing points of view. I myself am very sceptical about David Cameron.
I think turning to what he actually did or tried to do or failed to do, I mean, perhaps the major piece of legislation, leaving aside the constitutional issues just for a moment, the major piece of domestic legislation was the reforms to health and care, which from the current perspective don't seem to have been tremendously successful. It's quite hard to look elsewhere to see what else was really achieved. Single-sex marriage, of course, important for those who have benefited from it, but difficult to see much beyond that. And interestingly, when the Conservatives did win their 2015 majority, albeit a small one, again, apart from legislating for a referendum on the European Union, the legislative cupboard was bare. Should we interpret this as either the sort of Tory who was so content or complacent that he thought Britain was in a place that needed no real reform? Or should we just see this as someone who had very few political ideas?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, because you're absolutely right. There was a tremendous sense in which there was a vacuum after the 2015 election. Now, again, I mean, as you may recall, it was widely anticipated that the 2015 election would lead to a hung parliament. Most of the polls and the commentators had suggested that the outcome was too close to call. But even so, even if it had been a hung parliament, the Conservatives would have been the largest by far party of the hung parliament and one hung government, and one shouldn't have been reliant on one's coalition partners to suggest what you should do. Indeed, if we look at it from the perspective of now, I mean, and, you know, let's just put Brexit to one side. Look at it from the perspective of from now. Whether you consider from now the question of strains on the health service, relations with Scotland, the environmental issues, the question of transport, all sorts of the spread of drug abuse, all sorts of issues, and those are by no means exhaustive ones, response to Vladimir Putin. There are the questions of whether Cameron really was either engaged with them sufficiently or had ideas. And there is, you know, there is a sense that he had the manner of Blair, and I think the two of them were in that respect rather similar, but the Blair, I'm a critic of Blair, but the Blair was better able to envisage change and to then seek to try and execute it. I mean, Cameron talked about, you know, sort of a form of what we would call big tent conservatism, but didn't really seem to be able to offer it. And one of the interesting things is, the extent to which, you know, when Theresa May succeeded him as Prime Minister and her opening speech and her engagement with the plight of, in particular, working class whites left behind, the sort of people who were to help the Conservatives win the 2019 election and who had clearly played a significant role in the referendum. There was a sense that she was talking about and to people who Cameron simply could not engage with and, dare one say it, didn't seem to really care about. Now, I'm sure the latter is unfair, but there's not much sign that he was able to communicate, and part of being a prime minister is leadership. So there is a degree of which, you know, I mean, it's quite obvious he loved the company of his chums, you know, the sort of messing around you see in those silly diaries by that Swire woman makes it quite clear that he was happy flirting with you know, attractive women within a well, you know, a well-off old Etonian milieu. Fair enough if that was his hobby, but the practicality is, as Prime Minister, you're supposed to be able to communicate some sense of leadership, not only to your party, and I think Cameron's relationship with the Conservative Party was, you know, not good, but also with the country as a whole, which is more significant, not least because you are reliant on the country for a sense of an ability to discharge and further policies. And, you know, there was something missing there. Now, I might have been, you know, harsh. I don't think I have been harsh. I think I've been actually very accurate. And I do imagine, you know, when we're all dead and when Mr. Cameron's dead, I do imagine it would be interesting to see what government papers say about Greensill and say about other things that David Cameron did in influence peddling. But, you know, let's leave aside that. Let's just talk about, did he manage to engage adequately with the country, which is what you would want of a prime minister, so that those people who didn't vote for him still had some form of respect for him? And I personally don't sense that he did. I mean, you may have a different view, Graham.
No, I don't. He did have one idea, or at least one theme. Indeed, he made it at the heart of his manifesto, which was the big society, which was an interesting idea as a concept, quite a Tory idea as a concept, but seemed to be totally lacking in any substance. Do you see that as just simply he had an idea, never got round to implementing it because events got in the way and he was blown off course? Or is the idea of the big society simply a slogan of no substance, which too closely symbolises David Cameron?
I really don't know. I mean, I personally think that the big society didn't really get through to the public as a whole. Now, there's all sorts of ways of looking at the relationship between public and politicians. You could say the public gets the politicians they deserve. You could say politicians produce rhetoric or even deceit because that's what large chunks of the public want. And that may well be true, that politics becomes a branch of a sort of television reality show with the emphasis on the conditional nature of reality. Whatever is the case, I would argue that David Cameron failed to surpass the parameters of the politics that surrounded him. Whereas I think you could make a good case that really important politicians, and I would argue that for the 20th century, the two most important in Britain were Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, both did succeed in surpassing those parameters. And although I happen to think he was a totally, you know, limited individual, at least Tony Blair tried to. I think, in a sense, Cameron was a bad copy of Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, you say, to use a Churchill expression, he failed to make the weather, but was rather made by the weather.
I think so. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we must leave it there, Professor Jeremy Black, for marking David Cameron's homework and finding it sorely wanting. Thank you very much indeed.
Many thanks. And listeners may be interested in my book on Britain since 1945.